Today is August 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Taliban enter the capital of Afghanistan as its president and other senior members leave the country.
People look very worried, and they are very concerned about their security, about their future, about the 20 years of democracy.
Plus, what the Taliban says about its future government.
No disruption will take place in the work of government officials, women working outside, or girls seeking education.
And the latest from the White House. Our expanded coverage begins now. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, along with his vice president and other senior officials, flew out of the country on Sunday. The departure set the stage for Taliban insurgents to regain power in Afghanistan 20 years after a U.S.-led military invasion ousted them. Top members of the Taliban Military Commission arrived at the presidential palace in Kabul as Taliban fighters took positions at key posts within the city. Taliban spokesperson Zabihullah Mujahid confirmed on Sunday evening that the fighters were directed to guard security posts and other installations in Kabul to, quote, prevent chaos and looting after Afghan forces abandoned them, end quote. Mujahid urged the residents to remain calm, saying the move was meant to ensure the security of the people. There was no comment from Ghani as he left Kabul. In a recorded message on Saturday, he told the nation that he was consulting with both national and international players on the situation, which he called an imposed war. Abdullah Abdullah, the head of the Afghan National Reconciliation Council, posted a video on Facebook that criticized Ghani. Abdullah confirmed that Ghani had left Afghanistan and said, quote, "I feel the former president left the country and people in a bad position. God will make him accountable," end quote. The Taliban swept through most of the country in little more than a week and reached the gates of Kabul on Saturday. The insurgents initially stayed out of the city, maintaining they wanted a peaceful transition of power to spare Kabul any violence. Sources told VOA that Sunday morning, a Taliban delegation engaged prominent Afghan leaders, politicians, and elders in negotiations that culminated in Ghani stepping down from office. Reporter Zakira Safari is based in Kabul, and I spoke to him earlier this evening about what he saw throughout the day.
It was 11:45 in the morning. 11:45 a.m. at the morning, and I was at the passport commission office. When I came out from there, so I see the people was very worried, and a rumor was played in the Kabul that lots of people called each other that the Taliban entered in the Kabul through the west Kabul. I mean, from the Maidan Wardak, and the people of west Kabul were very worried. And it was a humor, and the people were worried about this, that the Taliban entered, and they are entering into the central Kabul. I mean, to the central Kabul. But it was lately known that it was a humor, and the Taliban were not in the city. They were out the city and standing for. They were in the position for a call. So. I seen that the banks, the academic house, the tuitions, the schools, and the supermarkets, and the shopping malls have been closed. The traffic deserted, and then the people were worried. And the streets, like what they, I saw, the streets were empty, and at least some places were like very traffic jam because of the maintaining traffic. But people looked very worried about this news. But lately, it was known that the news was a rumor. And afternoon, we heard and Taliban called that their commanders or their commanders or mujahids can enter the city. The PD stations in Kabul, like 13, 18, 6. And different PDs in Kabul were empty. The commanders took over and they left the PD, and the Taliban take over them. And they are in the PD right now in Kabul. At the same time we are talking, I can hear some firing shots. I mean, I can hear the sound of firing, but it's a single firing. It is not proper, and That's it.
You mentioned that people were concerned about the Taliban entering the city. You hear sporadic single shots taking place. We have had reports also of the international airport taking some fire as well. How do people feel in terms of their overall security as the day has progressed?
Of course, people are very worried about the situation. Mr. Ghani left Afghanistan and Mr. Amrullah Saleh left Afghanistan before two days ago. And Mr. Sarwar Danish, the second vice president, he left Afghanistan for Turkey. And lots of officials from Afghanistan left. It means that the people of Afghanistan is still alone and nobody cares about it and nobody worries about it. Before 2 hours, I knew that the Ministry of Defense, the Minister of Defense of Afghanistan, left Afghanistan for United States of Europe. And in the same time, the other official also left. I forget his name. Only Mr. Dr. Abdullah, Mr. Karzai, and Engineer Hikmatyar is in Afghanistan. And people look very worried and they are very concerned about their security, about their future, about the 20 years of democracy, art, cinema, photography, shows, filmmaking, social activity, human rights, blah, blah. People are looking very worried and they are very nervous. They do not know what happens tomorrow. Even me as a journalist, I really don't know what happens tomorrow, what I will see, what I will hear. Me and my wife, Zahra Yusufi, she is also a host for a television. And we both are very worried about the situation. As the same, the people or the local people are the same as the local people are worried about the situation of Afghanistan.
Speaking about worrying about the situation of Afghanistan, what are the people saying that you're speaking to there in Kabul about President Ashraf Ghani leaving, about the drawdown of U.S. troops, which was scheduled to take place by the end of this month? How are people reacting to the speed at which the Taliban were able to sweep across the country and enter the capital?
The people in the Afghan youth on Facebook, on the social platforms, they are blaming Ashraf Ghani for what he did. He left his country in a very bad situation, in a very bad days. People are hoping for the meeting tomorrow. Maybe the United Nations may have about Afghanistan's future or about Afghanistan's security. People are hoping at least a journalist and a social activist or the people who are educated in Afghanistan, they are very much hopeful for about the meeting, about tomorrow's United Nations meeting. Taliban, the new thing, which is very famous in the last 20 minutes in Afghanistan's social platform, is that Taliban said that we are not going to divide the power in Afghanistan. We are ruling our own in Afghanistan, and we are not thinking about any kind of discussion. People are hoping that America comes back and support the people of Afghanistan. And it is very important in this very, very, very tough situation for the people of Afghanistan. And people are hoping for the United Nations help, for the NATO help, for the America help, or for any single country who were helpful before 20 years for Afghanistan.
Zakira Safari spoke to me from Afghanistan's capital of Kabul. Speaking on Al Jazeera, a Taliban spokesperson told the network that the war in Afghanistan is over and that they stood ready to provide safety to those in the country, as well as those at diplomatic missions. He added that they'd be forthcoming soon with more details about their plans for the new government. VOA's Ayaz Ghul is in Islamabad, Pakistan, and he joins us now with what is known about the Taliban's future plans.
Now, the political transition has to be led by the political leadership of the Taliban. And we know for sure that the entire political leadership is currently based in Doha, the capital of Qatar. And that's where they signed the agreement with the United States in February 2020. So we know for sure that any political transition or activity from now onward is going to take place in Doha. And I have spoken to several Taliban officials, you can call them sources. Obviously, they don't want to revealed themselves as of at this stage. They have said that there's no going to be any interim government or any transitional government. The power transfer will take place and will be transferred to Taliban by a group of Afghan jihadi leaders, politicians in Kabul who are supposed to travel to Doha, and under the leadership of Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, who was a coalition partner in the President Ashraf Ghani's government, which is no more there. So these top Afghan leaders are supposed to travel to Doha, where the Afghan Taliban political leadership is based, and as representatives of the Afghan society, as we understand, this Afghan delegation in Doha will convey to the Taliban that now the country is under your control and you're welcome to rule it. When is that going to happen, and whether the ceremony of transfer of power to Taliban will take place in Doha or whether it will take place in Afghanistan, there is total uncertainty about it. No date has been announced.
Ayaz, have there been any other additional messages from the representatives of the Taliban about what they plan for the future?
As we speak, Taliban's deputy political affairs chief, Mullah Brother, who is also heading the Doha office, released a video statement in Pashto language, sitting in his office with all the Taliban members who participated in negotiations with the United States until a year ago and who are still in contact with the U.S. officials. So Mullah Brother, in his Pashto language speech, basically declared what he said is an unprecedented victory in Afghanistan that the Taliban have achieved. But at the same time, he appealed to Afghans and all influential leaders in the country to join hands with the Taliban to bring a permanent end to the miseries, according to him, that the Afghan nation has been suffering because of decades of conflict. So obviously, Taliban are trying their best to convey and convince the people that they are back in power, but that it is not the kind of Taliban movement that was ruling Afghanistan in the 1990s for 5 years, when they had implemented or imposed harsh Islamic laws, giving severe punishments to people and barring women from going out, working, or seeking education. This time, repeated statements have been issued in the last 24 hours by the Taliban leadership that no disruption will take place in the work of government officials, women working outside, or girls seeking education. And that media, in fact, there's a special statement that was issued today that media in Afghanistan will be working as freely as it has been, and there will be no bar on covering whatever activities Taliban conduct, so that they are able to know whether people are being threatened by Taliban fighters.
VOA's Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. officials watching armed Taliban fighters move into the Afghan capital of Kabul see American forces firmly control the U.S. embassy and the city's international airport, even as top U.S. diplomats describe the scene as heart-wrenching. U.S. President Joe Biden released a statement on Saturday that laid out his decision-making process for the U.S. withdrawal, but his administration received harsh criticism as events unfolded on Sunday. Joining us now is White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman with more. Steve, how has the White House responded not only to the events on the ground today in Afghanistan, but the criticism?
There hasn't been much that's come out of the White House except for some statements saying that the president was speaking with his national security advisor and secretary of state, along with a number of terse dispatches from the State Department, Defense Department, also a multinational statement, really putting the emphasis on getting people out of Afghanistan. So we really haven't had much about the surprising speed of the Taliban takeover and what an intelligence failure this has been for the United States government. That all is certainly to come in the days ahead. Now, the president on Monday is supposed to remain at Camp David, according to a schedule that has been released from the White House.
Steve, the former Steve, President Biden on Saturday released a letter where he said that part of what was happening in Afghanistan was due to the deal that the Trump administration struck with the Taliban in 2020. I'm wondering, what has the former president said about the events that have unfolded on Sunday?
Yes, former President Trump has put out a couple of statements, putting the blame squarely on his successor and saying that President Biden should resign. Fairly predictable response from the former president there. But there's also a lot of criticism coming from Democrats, members of the president's own party, who said, yes, we can, talk about, whether this should have been done at this particular juncture. But really, this is, they're saying, clearly a disaster, there was a failure of intelligence, not realizing how quickly the Taliban would take over and not being adequately prepared to get all these people out. We're going to see, Steve, congressional hearings about this. The House Intelligence Committee is already scheduling a classified briefing for its members. And really, the key is going to be, besides whatever human tragedies unfold in Afghanistan, is what sort of political price is Joe Biden going to pay for this? Because, as I've mentioned, he's being blamed by even members of his own party. The other aspect of it is, who is going to be held responsible? Will the president remove members of his national security team? Some are already suggesting that needs to take place. There are some signals that in the days ahead, we will have a national address from President Biden speaking about Afghanistan. But there's no indication that that's going to happen as soon as Monday.
Steve, in the time we have left, the president and other officials announced that up to 5,000 troops would be made available to help withdraw U.S. personnel from Afghanistan. What's the latest development on those efforts?
Yeah, that's up by another 1,000. So we're going to have a force of 6,000 supposedly to aid with this evacuation. The U.S. government has clearly now emphasized that the priority is on getting Americans out, locally employed staff of the U.S. State Department, the embassy there, which has been moved to the Kabul airport, and then others who have assisted the United States.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House bureau chief. The death toll in Haiti after a 7.2 magnitude earthquake rose to over 700 on Sunday. Joining us from just outside the capital of Port-au-Prince is reporter Anne Rose Schoen with additional details.
Problem is, it's not one earthquake, it was two earthquakes. And over 99.0 aftershocks. So you have to understand that the peninsula of Haiti is divided by a mountain range. And one earthquake was in the mountain, and one earthquake was in the water. So both sides of the peninsula have been affected, and both sides have damage. But the northern part of the peninsula cannot be accessed by road because the road is totally blocked with stones, and so you cannot go through. You only can reach this town, which name is Jeremy, by plane or by boat. And that is one logistic problem. And then you have all the little towns that are in the middle between these two oceans. I mean, on the north is the Atlantic Ocean, on the south is the Caribbean Sea. And they have been affected too. And these villages are very difficult to get to. This is really the backyard of Haiti. So in order to get all the information, it will take a long time. I guess that only by the end of this week, we will really know how many casualties there are and how many wounded people have been in this two earthquakes.
And in terms of getting aid to those areas that have been affected by these earthquakes on either side of the peninsula, what's being done to get what they need there?
So right now we have another problem. And the only road going out from Port-au-Prince and to the south is the road that goes to the southern part of the metropolitan area. And this southern part of the metropolitan area is completely controlled by gang members. So they are already saying that they will not let convoys through. So it will be seen in the next couple of days how it's going to be handled. That's happening this morning, for example, there was a plane landing in Lekai in the south, and that was a Dominican plane. The Americans will deploy, USAID will deploy around 80 people who come in with more than 10 pounds of specialized equipment for search and rescue. And they will fly the most heavily wounded back to Port-au-Prince. They will come in the next couple of hours if they're not yet already here and going over there. I mean, we are talking about Coast Guard, we are talking about military, we are talking about urban search and rescue teams. And then you have also other countries like Germany that is sending dogs in.
Anne Rochon reports from Pensionville, Haiti, which is located just outside of its capital. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A fuel tank explosion in Lebanon's northern region of Akkar Sunday killed at least 28 people and injured 79, many of them with bad burns, according to the Lebanese Red Cross. The incident comes amid severe fuel and power shortages, which has led to long lines at gas stations and extended blackouts. Dale Gavlak is up next.
The Lebanese army has opened an investigation into the fatal fuel tank explosion in Akkar, while President Michel Aoun called on the Supreme Defense Council to discuss a response. Members of the army and civilians are among the casualties. The circumstances of the explosion are still not clear. The army said it seized a hidden fuel storage tank from a camouflaged warehouse where some 60,000 liters of gasoline were stored. An order was given to distribute badly needed supplies to the residents. Some witnesses say that after the army left, a huge stampede took place to get the remaining gasoline in the tank and that it exploded in an open area. Fuel is becoming scarce and more expensive. Some blame the severe shortage on supplies being smuggled to Syria, hoarding, and the cash-strapped government's inability to secure deliveries of imported fuel. Central Bank Governor Riyad Salama also announced last week that government subsidies on fuel would be cut, causing prices to soar. Fuel is used for vehicles and to power electric generators, and shortages are forcing bakeries, hospitals, and other businesses to shut. Joseph Bahoud heads the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut. He says this is another terrible incident resulting from the lack of political will to tackle Lebanon's problems.
The money reserves at the central banks were clearly depleting. Everybody knows the subsidies cannot be sustained, but no one wanted to confront the reality and the situation. The governor said that he couldn't continue subsidizing the fuel. We start seeing incidents at the gas station. People gathered around a land where they know that a local politician stocks some fuel and gas in order to smuggle it to Syria. They wanted to take it by force. The explosion occurred. The incident is terrible. It is maybe, unfortunately, going to be replicated elsewhere.
Akkar Governorate on the border with Syria is one of Lebanon's poorest areas. Former Prime Minister Saad Hariri has urged Lebanese officials, including President Aoun, to take responsibility and resign. Hariri said on Twitter, "The Akkar massacre is no different from the Beirut port massacre." Hariri was referring to the devastation caused in August of last year when improperly stored ammonium nitrate at the Beirut port exploded, leaving nearly 220 people dead and swaths of the capital in ruins. The blast was recorded as one of the largest non-nuclear explosions in history. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
On Saturday, the American University of Beirut Medical Center said that it was facing an imminent shutdown on Monday as a result of those fuel shortages. That would lead to essential equipment to stop working, and the hospital said it could also lead to hundreds of deaths in the coming months. Earlier, I spoke with reporter George Eaton about the situation.
Well, Steve, we're talking about Lebanon's oldest and most prestigious university hospital here launching a warning and saying that 55 patients who depend on respirators, including 15 children and more than 100 people with renal failure, are now in an imminent threat of death. The statement underscored the severity of Lebanon's economic crisis, which has paralyzed the country. Fuel shortages have prompted many owners of large private generators to turn off their generators. So this is something that has caused a major crisis. We're talking here about people that are being threatened by death because there is no possible way to get any electric current to the hospital. Nothing has changed until now. The hospital has not received until now any fuel and may be forced to shut down. So these 40 adult patients and 15 children, as I said, living on respirators will die immediately, as the statement said.
So, George, what's being done to prevent that from happening?
Well, there has been a lot of phone calls, a lot of interferences, a lot of calls from public figures, from members of the government to intervene in favor of the American hospital. Until now, these have been statements. Action has not been taken, but it is expected to happen in the next hours because we're talking here about cancer patients, we're talking about children, we're talking about COVID patients, we're talking about people who rely on machines to stay alive. So it is being attended to, but not an action has been taken until now.
George, what led up to this? You mentioned the economic situation that Lebanon is facing. You mentioned that the hospital hasn't received fuel in recent time to get the generators up and running to prevent this. What led to this potential catastrophe?
Well, Lebanon is facing an unprecedented historical crisis politically and economically. The government is out of dollars, so they cannot import any fuel. There is a major fuel crisis in Lebanon. Devaluation has reached a very high level. People are missing bread, and even getting around the city has become something of a luxury. Electrical current is very scarce. Today, a local channel, MTV, reported that Lebanon is totally out of electricity, total blackout. And there is no statement by the government, whereas we stand to possibly having back the electrical current. Until now, there is a total blackout that has been there for 2 hours now.
George, can you talk more about this total blackout? Because we are, in fact, using WhatsApp to communicate back and forth, which requires power to run the internet.
Yeah, so they kept a few generators working. Those generators that are still working are providing minimal power to some private institutions, some basic phones, centrals, and structures. But these will run out eventually in the next 48 hours. So these are not sustainable. Today, the Lebanese army and yesterday night has been doing raids to confiscate fuel that was stored in illegal places by merchants that were going to sell it in Syria. This fuel has been disseminated in the country to vital stations and to places where it is needed to keep on the country going. Estimations have it that these amounts of fuel that has been gathered by the Lebanese army will help the country sustain for the next 2 to 3 days maximum. After that, there will be an imminent need to import fuel.
That was George E. reporting from Beirut, Lebanon. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller in Washington, and until next time, be well, be safe, and have a good day.